King John was not a good man. He had his little ways. Always wanted to say that. 800 years ago tomorrow, he put his seal to one of the most significant documents in world history, well, Anglophone history at any rate, Magna Carta. We're talking about it a lot this week on RN, Democracy Week, we're calling it. Lots of lovely radio to mark 8 centuries since this 3,500-word declaration of rights and liberties. We kicked it off here on Sunday Extra a little earlier this morning. We had a very fine bluffer's guide to the whole Magna Carta thing. That's up on the RN website now if you need a bit of background. If you don't know your Runnymede from a hole in the ground, you will be the wiser by next Sunday, so stay tuned. Magna Carta, it's more than an 800-year-old piece of pigskin. It's part of our sense of our democratic selves, our notions of liberty. I suspect Tim Wilson would agree on that. He's a human rights commissioner, a freedom commissioner, in fact, a man of strong libertarian sympathies. Tim Wilson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Is there a framed copy of Magna Carta somewhere in Shays, Tim?
Can I tell you honestly, the first gift I got given after being appointed Australia's Human Rights Commissioner is somebody came and dropped off a replica of Magna Carta to my office. I am not kidding you. So it is not framed, but I do have one.
You do have one there.
That's right.
I'm sure it informs well, a lot of all our notions, as I say, of liberty, of democracy, and I suspect in your particular case, as a libertarian man, as you describe yourself as a classical liberal, a lot of those ideas go back to this moment, 800 years ago.
Well, a lot of those ideas or the principles that sit behind it are evoked out of Magna Carta and the idea that we, you know, power should not be concentrated in the hands of the few, that power should be devolved to citizens in different forms, but also to institutional structures, which we, you know, today's terms call the separation of powers. I mean, we can get very, I'm a romantic about Magna Carta and its legacy, but you know, we also need to recognise that it was the equivalent of sort of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, perhaps in 1215. But if you held the two documents up to each other, it's only the principles that survive, rather than the literal text, which covered lots of very time-specific socio-political matters and economic matters.
Well, crucially, the removal of fish weirs from the Thames and Medway rivers is.
Well, that's right, and in a later edition, there was an issuing of the Forest Charter, which covered what people could do within the King's Forest, essentially, and that included, both literal forests, but also a lot of other sort of field-type areas. And so, actually, Magna Carta, one of the things that's sort of perhaps not well understood is that it was as much a socio-political document as it was an economic document about essentially economic rights at the time. One of the key impetus that led to the barons revolting, forcing King John to sign Magna Carta, was taxation and taxation without consent. And if you want to read a good essay on this, it was written by Hugh Harley and published recently in the Australian Financial Review.
You say romantic view of this. I mean, dip into that for us a bit more deeply. In what way does this evoke that sort of sense for you?
Well, I think it evokes that sense for me because if you look back at the evolution of the Anglosphere, Western liberal democratic thought, the evolution of the Enlightenment and Enlightenment thinking about the role of the individual versus the government and restrictions on government. When you sort of take it back to a critical point in history, particularly in English thought, it really sort of exploded through Magna Carta. Now, there are lots of different traditions and historic philosophical traditions that are involved in the point after Magna Carta. But I think that you can say is a sort of the catalyst moment where people said, you know, the king, it's not just that we know the king isn't, the source of all authority. It's that that we, the people, have some degree of authority, and that there are other institutions which have to keep check on the king's authority, you know, like courts and like what came out was the common council of the barons. Of course, some of these ideas weren't necessarily new. There was democracy before before the evolution of English democracy that came out, you know, in, at least was the Common Council was a forerunner of that from Magna Carta, as there was similar sort of separations of powers. But I think if you look at it in terms of English traditions, that's where it came out.
Australian Human Rights Commissioner Tim Wilson is with us. We're talking Magna Carta. Why? Well, it's 800 years old tomorrow, and here on RN we're running Democracy Week, all week, looking at Magna Carta and the issues arising, kicking it off here on Sunday Extra. I mean, it's an interesting thing, Tim. You talk about the economic aspects and the there's sort of a view of liberty out of this that is a little about the few and not the many. I mean, and this was very much so at the time. We're talking, when we talk about Magna Carta, of the rights and liberties of the sort of the baronial class, really.
Mm.
Does that filter down to sort of modern notions based around sort of trickle-down liberties? Does it?
Well, I mean, you've got to look at Magna Carta in the context of the time where, of course, you had these sort of very large land-owning barons and you had the king, and that was, you know, the basically the governing class of the nation. And, of course, the barons didn't just fight for themselves. They also fought for the freedom of the English Church, which is these days we would call the Catholic Church, and they had many similar grievances. But the idea
of course, hated Magna Carta.
That's right. But as time evolved, the idea that these sorts of principles about rights against the state went from being about barons to progressively being about men, and then people starting to, you know, question, well, why don't these apply to women? John Stuart Mill was a very strong believer in, for instance, as a very strong believer in the rights of women, and they should be treated equal as men. And then as it's gone through history, we've sort of enlarged the body for which rights have been created. Because, of course, even up until about 1948, the whole sort of concept of rights in the way that we understand it today was something of the Anglosphere. And it wasn't until, of course, the Universal Declaration of 1948 that it took these ideas and said, well, actually, they're applicable across the world to everybody, regardless of the colour of your skin or what country you reside in. And Magna Carta was sort of the core of those principles that took them forward and started that evolutionary process.
And yet to take a line through from Magna Carta to modern sort of market-based notions of freedom, this is a view of liberty that's all about removing impositions on property, and that's a view which does little for the propertyless, and that was true then as it might be now in that sort of market context.
Property rights and what that meant at the time was incredibly important, of course, because it was the base in which people created wealth. Its taxation is essentially, you know, the confiscation of government by consent or a form of consent of private property. And so that continues today because, you know, markets have to be seen as broadly fair and just to enjoy purchase amongst the public. But particularly when you get to that period around the Enlightenment, about the need for people to have very basic rights over essentially a form of subsistence, it takes these ideas from being a philosophical concept, but one that has a pragmatic application, and starting to enlarge the benefit. And of course, that comes about even later with the Universal Declaration, where people started talking about people having basic rights to housing, etc.
But in our post-Enlightenment world, Tim, is there sort of an enduring presumption that the liberty of the wealthy is somehow synonymous with the liberty of all?
Well, I don't think so, because there is always going to be greater choice and greater liberties that people enjoy as a consequence of work and effort. That will always be the case. But you need to have a formal system of treating everybody equally before the law and providing them with the opportunity to participate in society. And so I think that's where the aspiration is, just the degree of which people can exercise those rights and have the freedom to exercise those rights will always, to a certain extent, be unequal.
What should we? What thought should we hold in our minds on this 800th anniversary of Magna Carta? Do you think?
I think that in the end, I think the biggest contribution of Magna Carta is this idea of government by consent. When you look at what the barons vote against and the idea of the Common Council, it established the principle of taxation by consent. But once you started that idea of, you know, taxes only being levied because the people who were going to be taxed consented to it, it started to build the idea that you didn't just get to decide whether you were taxed, but you also got to decide whether the tax was legitimate or not, and then whether the purpose of what the governing class was doing reflective of your view or not. So from that, you get all of the other institutional structures that preserve and protect our freedoms.
Tim Wilson, thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.